financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Frances Rayum. Hello.
Well, hello, Jay. How are you?
Good, good. Beautiful good. Day.
It's a beautiful day, and we have beautiful guests. So I'd like to welcome back, because they've been here once before, but never in a special edition like this. I'd like to welcome back Angela and Mike Torville from Annie Mac Mortgage. So hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Hello.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
You're
always
welcome.
Glad to be back. Yeah.
You're welcome. So let me just give you a brief little background on each of them. Angela is a seasoned mortgage professional, and she's built a reputation as being a lifelong mortgage advisor. In no small part, because she has built a team of experts who support someone through the entire mortgage process. She's not just there when you write your app, you close your loan, you're done. Okay. Mike brings with him, a lot of experience in this industry as well, a deep understanding of the industry, an extensive mortgage lending experience. And he's actively involved in things like community outreach and financial education initiatives, which is how our paths crossed initially. We want people to be smarter about money. And one of the biggest purchases you will ever make is real estate. Welcome back to both of you. Could I start by asking, whichever one of you would like to answer, or both, what about this crazy mortgage market right now? Quick little background in March, right? In March, we had resale housing slump. We had new housing spike. Okay. Who wants to start?
Angela, you're deeper into it, so I would defer to you on this one. How's that?
Sure. It's super hyper local. One neighborhood to the next is complete different ballparks. Then you get the strategies of realtors maybe underlisting homes and creating a ton of attention. Quick little story. I was on a walk with a pretty high producing listing agent this morning in our area, Hamden County. And she was saying how, she was attracting 30 to 40 people in one day through an open house, but she was only receiving 3 or 4 offers. And in my opinion, and I did have a buyer that was had an offer in on that home, and my buying agent thought that it was underpriced. So I just think that the consumers are a little bit hesitant and scared because they're realizing it's a very big commitment, right? Mm-hmm. And the uncertainty with the economy.
Mm.
So they don't, the commitment, they want to make sure it's the right one.
Right.
And so I think the buyers are being a little more particular. And people have been promising rate declines. And we're just not there, right?
So those people. 6% fixed now? Is that what it is?
What headline are you reading?
I've got averages about 6.83% average right now.
Probably more like it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, Angela, you're right. But think about this. It's compounded with all the other external stresses, right? The stock market's volatile, the tariff situation, the employment market. Lots of people that I've been speaking to recently are a little nervous. So I might lose my job. There's things that are unstable. There's a lot of uncertainty that compounds, obviously, their stress. And it translates into the real estate market. So you've got many things happening that are unusual all at the same time. And it's unpredictable right now. I mean, you can listen to the experts and they contradict each other, and
yes,
it's hard to say where we're going.
Yeah, that's true. I think, with the resale market slowing down in March, I think it slumped to 5.9%, which was the worst monthly decline since, 2022, I think. But the new home sales spiked up, right? They surged to 7.4%, I think. based on what I'm reading, is builder incentives and more affordable housing options, right? So more affordable housing options is probably in your camp because you do lots of things, especially for first-time home buyers, to make things easier for them. Can you talk a little bit about what Annie Mac Mortgage does and what you do through the Momentum Group and through your own skills to help somebody get into a home that maybe thought they couldn't afford it?
Well, we can definitely help with the competition, right? But you're leading into a question, which is a big question I ask in my consultations, because what I can compute someone to afford is not necessarily what they can afford. And so one of the biggest questions I ask in my, because we always do an initial consult to get, goal gathering and situation, because this is a very situational transaction, right? It's specialized to, or actually personalized to that individual. And the big question is, what is your ideal mortgage payment? And that's where the power lies. I don't think it lies in the purchase price, because I can craft a mortgage around that ideal payment and the assets that we're willing to let go of, or the assets we want to retain. And so everyone's very focused on, and I might be getting off your actual question at this point,
No,
but
this is perfect.
they're very focused on purchase price because there's a lot of outside noise. And I won't say what roles in the real estate team have that noise, but they push to purchase price. And so when I'm dealing with a client to give them that power and confidence when they're in the market, is knowing their box. And that starts with the ideal payment. And so from there, we can take it wherever we need to take it. But at the end of the day, they can be confident and aggressive and compete within their means. So when they go to bed at night, if they won that offer or if they didn't, they're satisfied still.
So I love it when I ask someone a question that takes them a second to think about it, because it means we're digging in a little deeper than somebody might on a typical and typical show. So yeah, I think all of that is true. How people decide what they can afford for a mortgage is a complete show all of its own, right? But let's suppose that they decide this is what we can afford, and because they've maybe been to another bank somewhere or another lender, or they just looked it up on the internet and said, here's what my mortgage payment is. They've seen that means you can afford a $175,000 house. And they say, oh, I can't find anything for $175,000. One of the things I notice, I'm wondering if you notice the same thing, that people forget about. Maybe I should ask you, what do you think people forget about? What don't they know about a mortgage if they're a first-time home buyer? What do they not know that you wish they knew?
Can I just say something real quick before Angela? Because I'll give her more time to
A
think
big
about that.
question. Yeah.
Since you, and the thing is, we always stress, and I encourage people. There's two things: one, education and preparation. Okay, but early as possible, as advanced as early on in the process. Because what happens sometimes, it's a Chinese fire drill. We found a house over the weekend, and we need you to qualify us by 2 o'clock. I wait. What? And you've got puzzle pieces of income that you have to figure out, and it's all done in a rush. And then there's things that they didn't, and they waste a lot of people's time sometimes when you find these gaps or qualifying criteria that needs longer explanations or research to figure that out. So the earlier the better, the more education and preparation, the better. So you can avoid those last minute Chinese fire drills. I know Angela encounters that a lot. So what we would say when you're saying, okay, I'm going to start looking for a house, pause. Consult. And I know Angela, and when you were speaking earlier, you used the word consult a few times, because that's what you have to do early on to position somebody early, so they're not going through all the motions with no result. Anyway, that's now that you've have time to think about your better answer.
Actually, I'm going to jump in the middle, Angela. I'm going to give you just a second more and say, Mike is spot on here. What I find people do, what they think the housing purchase market is I go online or I figure out how much money I think I can afford. I calculate by some quick method how much house I can buy, or I get pre-approved for how much house I can buy, and I go and I shop. And because I'm shopping for a $300,000 house, because that's what I'm approved for, guess what I end up finding? A $350,000 house. And what does pre-approved mean anyway, right? So people are making these giant decisions about getting a mortgage, something they are going to partner with the rest of their adult life, or in our case, much shorter, but still many years, right? Without really giving it its due diligence and learning upfront what you're going to do, how you prepare for this sort of thing. I mean, absolutely. All right, Angela, back to you for your question.
Well, my
Answer.
brain went to a million different things of what I want them to know after all
Great.
that. One thing I maybe there's a lot to know, and again, I think it comes back to situational. It's situational. It always is, right? There's all kinds of factors. What I try to provide and what I want them to buy into when they work with me is trust. You know, I want them to trust that I'm not going to make number one a decision for them, but I'm going to give them everything they need to make it on their own.
Yes.
And you know, as far as affordability, that is, you know, I've seen the average income of, you know, $75,000 being able to get into a $350,000 home turn into now 120,000. You know, the median incomes are they're not increasing, but the affordability on them are as far as to get in. So it comes back to developing resources. What resources do you have that you don't know you have? And Fran, you might not like this one, but I go, hey, you have a 401k.
Oh,
You might have a family member, and quite
right.
honestly, most people don't realize, and I have to assure them because I have the bird's eye view. They have their own bubble that they're looking
Sure,
in. And I have to
that's
assure
right.
a lot of first-time home buyers, you know, 60% of the time right now, parents are helping them get into the home. They're helping with the assets.
Yeah,
It's
you're
a big
right.
thing going
It's
on
not
right
that I
now.
don't. I'm sorry, Angela. You're right. It's
No
not that
problem.
I don't like it because it's your money. I don't like doing it the wrong way. I don't like them taking a withdrawal out and getting whacked 20% penalty because they're under 59 and a half, and I mean a 10% penalty and 20% on taxes, you know. But you can borrow against your 401k and pay yourself back. That's one way to possibly do it. I try to help people conserve their dollars as much as possible because that $20,000, $30,000 that they might be wanting to borrow against their 401k to help them with a down payment might turn into, $100 a month in a payment over the course of time. And they can more easily tolerate the $100 a month and leave the money in the market where they can grow it for their retirement someday, especially if they apply something like our system that pays the debt off quickly, including the mortgage, right? But I tend to look at it from an advisory standpoint like that. Like, yes, I want you to get into a home. That's what money is for you to achieve your lifestyle goals. But I want you to do it the smartest way possible financially. Where I was headed, and folks, if you're listening to this, you can tell that this is why Mike and Angela and I are talking, and I'm not talking to a big box bank VP because these folks think like this about your mortgage. Okay, they actually care whether you're going to be able to afford to have this house or not, in part because of their in-house program, which we can talk about because that's part of what makes them a different lender, makes Annie Mac a different lender. But where I was headed with that, I almost forget now. I did forget. Where was I headed?
I think I know where you were headed, how we can give an edge to our
No, it
clients.
was just before that, talking about finances and. Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, I'll pick it up from there and edit it out. But anyway, they actually, if they actually care about what happens for you, the one thing that I was hoping Angela would say, but she's got so many things she wants people to know and remember when they're getting a mortgage for first-time home buyers and maybe even people who have already owned a home and are looking again, they forget taxes and insurance. They go and pre-qualify for how much house they can afford based on a principal and interest payment. And taxes and insurance change your life. So you got to go talk to professionals like this before you put your offer in on your house, before you go shopping and find out what a real pre-approval, and that is not an approval, but what a real pre-approval means. So Mike, this might be a good question for you, even though I know Angela has the answer too. But in terms of education, what's available at Annie Mac to get people to understand this stuff before they get themselves in trouble?
Well, there's a lot, and there's so many things that now I forgot what I was going to say. See, it's contagious, isn't it?
Good.
But one of the things is you say, look, it is. You said taxes and insurance. When's the last time your property taxes decreased?
Right.
When's the last time your insurance decreased? Okay. Now your mortgage principal and interest payment may stay the same for the duration of the loan, but there's a strong likelihood both your taxes and insurance are going to increase over time. So you have to think about that, not just the amount, but they're likely to go up and increase your mortgage payment all in.
That's right.
So that's always something to consider too. I'm glad you brought that up. And the other thing too is we encourage our borrowers to seek advice from a financial advisor, because some of the things you mentioned, if they're going to put 20% down and they say, I'm going to put 20% down and get 6.8 with no points, perfect. They've decided that at their kitchen table and they think, well, that's what Angela presented. Well, that's what my loan officer said. So that's what I'm going to do. Well, why don't we pause and think? Because does it really make sense to use an asset to put 20% down? Maybe there's some other consideration to put less down, reserve the assets, and your monthly payment might be adjusted by just so much. Yeah, what about paying 1 point or 2 points to change your rate? And
Right.
we have a program, and Angela uses it often, and every borrower called Mortgage Coach, where we compare paying a point or two, paying 10% down versus 20% down, how that affects your PMI. So the point is, it's a big picture where having some professional advice can help you say, here's how this is going to impact your assets, your 401k, your cash flow. And to look at that whole picture from an outside third party is, we encourage that because it's very helpful, because that's when people have the aha moment, go, oh, I didn't think of that. I didn't think that was an option. So we try to encourage people to do that and present them with those choices. So in the end, nobody's going to second guess and say, oh gosh, I wish we had known this.
Yes. Well, you brought up another perfect point of things that people don't think about. They don't think about PMI. For those of you who don't own homes with PMI, that's private mortgage insurance. I call it throwing money out the window, but that's what I get to say from my side of the
I
desk.
agree with that.
I thought you might, Jay.
I just say thank you for, paying some insurance for the lender, because in the end, that's
Yeah,
what it
exactly.
is.
Oh boy, I have a great question for you sometime, but it's going to drag us way into another topic. But remind me to ask you about PMI and the housing bubble. That would be fun. But Jay, I thought you might agree with that, because, private mortgage insurance you pay because you have less than 20%, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, of course, less than 20% equity in your home, right? Some mortgage clauses say you have to have 20% equity, or you have to have paid in for 2 years before you can try to get rid of your private mortgage insurance. Okay. Private mortgage insurance is going to cost you X number of dollars a month. It's insurance. What you're doing is insuring the lender in case you default on your loan. That can be hundreds of dollars a month for people, which could make the difference if you have a creative lender like Angela or like Mike, right? It could make the difference between how much house you can afford and how much house you can't afford because you had PMI. And there are ways to get around it. There are creative ways to get around PMI, if it's the right thing for you to do, and if the numbers come out right. But Mike is correct. You need to zoom out and look at the big picture. And I'm going to just step in here and say, yes, ask your financial advisor. But get your antennas up, because not all financial advisors will either know this stuff or care, or they would prefer to keep your money in the market for some reason that maybe doesn't have much to do with you buying your house. I'm not suggesting nefarious means. I'm just saying they may have a different vision than you have. So you got to get somebody who's going to come to the table with your mortgage brokers or mortgage lenders, excuse me, and say, I like where you're headed. Like, I've seen the software that Angela uses. It's very good. It gives you a really good comparison about how to do this well. And she uses it, I think, almost on every deal, right? And so you get a lot of you get a lot of material there, a lot of input that you might not get at a typical lender. And this is a good time for me to say, I don't make any money on this. I'm not affiliated with Annie Mac. I don't get any overrides. This is it. I just happen to like their model and I wanted to have them on again soon.
Can we get the phone number, Francis, from you for people?
Of course, they can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Of course, as always, you can go to hugyourmoney.com. And we will be back with more financial fitness with the money doctor, Francis Ram, coming right up. This is Financial Fitness with the money doctor, Francis Ram, on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Francis Ram, and the Torvilles. Very happy to have you here. Great stuff. Great stuff.
Thanks, Jay. Yeah.
Can I throw a couple things in real quick?
Sure.
My wife and I got our house in 95, had it built. Thank goodness it's paid off. And we were talking before the break about PMI. And I thought, and maybe you guys could answer this question for me, because I always want to know the answer. It did not drop off after our levels got to that certain point. Was that because that law didn't go into effect until after 95? I was asked to jump through hoops. Oh, you need a comparison. You need this. You need
you need
that.
An appraisal or
and
enough
I asked,
equity.
I said, no, I say, they said they had already done an appraisal. I said, send it to me. They sent me the original comparative before the house was built.
No, and you got to prove that you've paid your loan down by that amount or you get an appraisal that shows you have that much equity in the house. Angela and Mike may have a different slant because their finger's right on the pulse, but what say you?
Well, one of the things that kicks in, and then Angela can elaborate on this, is when your loan value reaches 78% or lower, it should come off. But the obvious thing is, who's going to know? How are you going to convey that to your lender to say now it's time? Because they're not looking out for you. We are, but you know, so that's one thing. Angela, you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, what you said, Jay, is they're going to go off original value. Hmm. You know, so they do make you jump through some hoops. And what's happening right now with the appreciation we've seen since COVID is a lot of people are at that loan to value percentage before 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so they're thinking they can drop it. So with my servicer, if I log into my mortgage application, it'll tell me how many years are left until I reach that percentage. If I want to drop it before then, yes, I have to prove the value and typically with an appraisal, and then they have to agree upon it and they charge a fee to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're paying $150, $250 a month in PMI, it's worth the $500 fee and $600 for the appraisal, in my opinion.
Right.
Some programs are PMI for life, though.
Like an FHA
your FHA loan is PMI for life. So you have to actually get out of the loan to drop that. So that you can, let me go back a little bit though. If you put 10% down or more with an FHA loan, it will actually fall off, but typically people aren't doing that in that lending
environment.
We put down
5, as I recall, 5%.
Yeah, typical. Yeah, that's a typical down payment. But there's more ways to pay your PMI than monthly. And that's when we get into strategy. That's when we get into strategy.
I love that word strategy. All right. Tell us, Angela.
Oh, okay. Well, it sort of goes hand in hand with the high interest rate environment we're in. So with the presentation that we use, a lot of people are still conditioned that 20% down is what you need to do to get into a house. And this is where a lot of people say, I'll never do it. And that's true. Right. So, but they'll come to the table with 20% down. And sometimes what I'll show them is the 20% down that they wanted to put. And then maybe I'll show them 18% down and buying out their PMI for a small fee and using the additional funds out of that 2% we saved to permanently buy down their interest rate. So now they're netting the same cash out, but their monthly payment could have been saved almost $300 a month, spending the same amount of money, which in turn could increase their purchase power too, which would allow them to be maybe pre-approved up to 400
Right.
But look at those $300,000 homes and leave that wiggle room for bidding and competition. So, really hard to understand that though if you can't see it. So that's why we consult visually.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was going to mention that earlier. There's choices to pay it up front or a combination up front monthly. Certain loan programs will allow that. And if you're strong on your assets but weak on the debt ratio and payment, this might be an option to solve that, and vice versa. So when we spoke earlier, and Angela saying, look, when you talk about creative ways, and I bet you, I know a lot of loan officers, lenders won't offer this or think about it. And a lot of borrowers then therefore don't know about it. And that's what I was saying earlier. Later on, when you learn these things after the fact, you start, gee, I could have done that. Had I known, it would have made more sense. So,
Have a
a really
really
good.
cool. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Angela.
There's another really cool insight. Most lender, just speaking of lazy lenders. With the new pricing adjustments that we've had over the last couple of years, you're going to get a better interest rate at 5% down than 10.
Really?
How does that
Really?
work?
Well, there's price adjustments based on loan to values and credit score. So back in the day when Mike was writing loans left and right, and I was probably in middle school still, he had to manually calculate his interest rate. Now we have technology, but if you know the behind that technology, you know as a lender, you know, yeah, I know they want to put the higher down payment, but if we put the lower down payment, maybe we buy out the MI, and maybe we can take that chunk and do what's called a recast after we close. Now we ended up with the lower rate, no PMI, even though we did a low down payment, and a recast is almost the same as putting that money down when you purchased, but doing it on the back end. So you end up with the best of all the worlds.
Yeah, and explain what recast means, because it doesn't come up that often,
It
Angela.
doesn't. It's such a
That's right.
great strategy to all the equity out there. So recasting is when you have a lump sum payment, and you want to put it down on your mortgage balance. If you were to just make the payment, you're pay down on the balance and lower your balance, your payment does not recalculate.
That's right.
A recast is recalculating your payment based on that new balance over the remaining term of the loan that you have. Some would call that sounds like a refinance. Well, guess what? It's not, because we're not refinancing your loans. You get the same terms. You're
Right.
just recalculating the balance for a nominal fee, maybe $300 to $700 to get that done. So that's another strong strategy.
It's brilliant to say to recast up front like this as one of your strategies. I didn't know you did that, but it's
Oh
brilliant.
yeah.
I love it.
I
Dan, we're such geeks, right? We're such financial
know.
geeks.
It's
We're like getting all
it
excited about
works.
this stuff.
I
But that's a real
know.
strategy that you would not know. I promise you, you walk into any big box bank, somebody call me. If you walked into a big box bank and said something like this, and they had even any idea what you're talking about, never mind that they proactively tell you, hey, here's a way to get you into this house. I just want to thank Angela and Mike Torville again
Thank you both.
for coming on from Annie Mac Mortgage and mention that they're part of the Momentum Group.
Francis, can you give the phone number again if people have questions for you?
Sure, of course, Jay. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. Angela and Mike, thank you very much. This is Financial Fitness on WHMP.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Do you like this?
I just love that you used belly. We check an X-ray of the belly. I could see it now on the medical charts in school. And what's this part, Alex? That's the belly. I love it. Okay.
We do a hysterosalpingogram, which
Thank you.
is
Do that three times
laparoscopic
fast.
evaluation of the pelvis, the fallopian tubes.
I just love that you mixed it, that you made it accessible. You know, we do all these medical things, and the belly is very cute. I can see why you're popular. Yeah. Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, Please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. I'm Jay Dean, and we're very excited for this show.
We are. We have a wonderful guest today. His name is Dr. Alexander Kucherov, and he is double board certified in OBGYN, or obstetrics and gynecology.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and Dr. Alex. And I noticed I did not call you Dr. Dreamy, but you are very handsome, so it's...
And I thought you were going to escape that with Jay this time.
I watched the whole show, the previous show, you know. So
Jay just was flirting with him.
Well, that's okay.
He had to say, "My wife."
Not okay
with
the missus, but I mean, you know,
that's all right. I think his wife is probably pretty.
It's very nice to. I mean, you're going to talk to a doctor who, you know, and obviously Dr. Alex really cares about the situation, the whole system, you know, and it's. You want to go in there and know that you've got somebody who's going to give you the answers or give you the right, send you the right direction. You know, This is great. This is great.
So I want to ask you, because, you know, finance is an integral part of this, right? In your experience, do you find that even financial stress itself can, and it's okay if your answer is no, it's fine, you know, but can it influence the emotional or even the physical side of the fertility treatment?
Absolutely, it can. And sometimes it puts people that need fertility treatment in awkward positions about having to make specific decisions about how they want to proceed. You know, specifically, I can think of a couple of my patients right now that are trying to decide, because of their coverage situation, which treatment they want to do, because they might have coverage for this, but not for that. And this is going to be out of pocket, but this is covered, but has a lower chance of success. And the timing that goes into that and the psychological impact of that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hmm. So I wonder when people come to you, if they start out right away talking about how expensive is this going to be? Or what's the process like when somebody comes to you and says, we've been trying to have a child and something's not working? You know, they're coming to you for answers. I'm sure you must have a place that you start. Can you talk a little bit about that?
From a financial standpoint?
No, the whole process. But yes, I'm sure you must discuss with them. Look, this doesn't have to be super expensive. We're going to start here. These things. I guess what I'm saying is the cost timelines don't always align with the timelines for having the babies. How do you balance that? How do you explain how to balance that? And what kind of help is available to people?
So our goal generally is to help people get pregnant and have a baby like yesterday. Like, that's the goal, right? Yeah. Before patients even sit down for a visit with us, we have a whole benefits authorization team that runs their insurance and puts it in the chart. And we have all of the benefits in front of us at the first visit. So I like to actually take the patient through their benefits at the end of the visit to talk about, hey, we ran your insurance. Here's what you have coverage for. This is here, and here's your deductible, and so on and so on. And here's what you met already, because it's all typically quite up to date. But we also have a separate finance and insurance advocate that every patient has that separately reaches out to the patient within a day or two to go over all of that in a little bit more detail. Separate from that person, we have a different authorization team that, once we know what the treatment strategy is going to be, contacts the insurance company to get all the authorizations in place. The point of all this is to try to take as much off the patient's plate as possible so they can focus on the medicine, on the medical care.
Yeah, the reason I asked is because I have seen it in our practice that people are waiting. And sometimes they're waiting until their jobs are better and they can afford things. That's one reason, right? And it's probably very common. And other times they're waiting because they just feel that it will be frightfully expensive and they won't be able to afford to do it. So in your experience, how much do you think affordability affects when or whether couples actually pursue fertility treatment?
I think the fear of the unknown is the biggest challenge. People come into fertility and they don't know how much it's going to cost. It's not usually listed in people's insurance benefits, as an example. Like they talk about you go to your primary doctor, you get a surgery, but the fertility stuff is usually buried really deep. And
Yeah.
so we have a whole team that has to call them, physically call them and get the ben and figure out the benefits. So it's not obvious sometimes what people's fertility benefits are. If people are self-pay, that's a little bit easier because we can just send them our table of what all the costs are ahead of time.
Right.
And we do have, as we talked about in the last show, we do have a company that we work with that does financing and fertility loans and helps with egg freezing and embryo freezing and everything else in between.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, the unknown is the challenging part. Once we can say, okay, here's what's covered, here's how much it's going to cost, that actually puts people at ease. More than maybe even with the num if there's numbers involved, what the numbers are, it's like, okay, at least now I know and I can kind of process that and be able to make the decision about how to move forward.
You know, it's true about everything. I don't know why we would think this would be any different. Everything is always scarier when you don't have the knowledge, when you don't have somebody professional you can ask the questions of, right? And so I think it's common, I think, for people probably, you'll tell me for sure, but to wait longer than they should because of the fear of that cost. And in fact, that can cost them everything, right? I mean, at least freeze your eggs. If you're sure you want, I don't have children, so I'm not saying, hey, I've got six kids running around and I love being a mom. It's not that at all. But for people who know they want a family, you know, I don't know that you can tell us what it costs to freeze your eggs. Maybe you can give us a ballpark.
Sure. I mean, it's about $8,000 to do an egg freezing cycle. It's different between different practices in different parts of the country. About $8,000. Most of that goes into the embryology lab for the actual physical process and paying the people that work there to do the whole process of actually freezing the eggs. There's a lot of components to that that cost money. There's also there's an anesthesia component to it. That is not free to go to sleep and have the eggs actually retrieved and all the monitoring and blood work and ultrasounds and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't include medications, and how much medicine you need really depends on what the underlying numbers are and how much of an ovarian response we expect to get. But that's why we do all the testing ahead of time, is to be able to counsel people appropriately about what their expectations should be. And then, of course, see how it goes. And at a certain point, it is dynamic. This is iterative in some ways. You kind of have to see how it goes using a certain approach and then make modifications to that if they do it in the future.
But if you think of that, like, so to put that into perspective, it's way more than the cost of a latte a day, but it's about 25% of probably the car you're driving, right? So if you think of it in terms of, now I'm really in money doctor mode, right? If you think of it in terms of what your life goals are and what's important to you and making choices, 8,000, I know that can be a ton of money for some people. Maybe not so much for other people who thought it would be more expensive, but in most cases, somehow financeable. You know, I hate to say credit card because I absolutely abhor the interest rates credit cards do, but people put more foolish things on credit cards. Disney vacations, 5 grand. What minimal, right? I mean, what the heck? You got to think about what is important to you and whether you want to, see that as self-insurance. Are you going to pay this money now to protect your ability to have children later? Or are you going to wait? Now you got to be sure you want a family, right? I mean, you can't be going, well, you know, maybe I'll just freeze my eggs because that's like the hip thing to do, right? You have to say, I know we want a family, but in my case, if clients were sitting in front of me, I might say, okay, financially, it's not looking great right now. If you think you're going to send these kids to college and you're going to be able to feed them, you're not there right now. But let's put it on our radar and start planning financially for the place where you need to be. In the meantime, you're not going to stop aging. And so we don't have the luxury. I say the same thing to people who are retiring. We don't have the luxury of getting this wrong right now. You've got 3 years to retirement. We've got to get it right, right? Or something like that. So I think. Certainly, you've brought something to light for me. I will ask clients more often when they're young about their plans to have a family. And although I'm certainly not here to tell them what to do, this is something I could bring up and say, have you considered that by the time you're financially ready to do this, you might not be physically able to do this? And maybe that means we want to fund this at this point. and there's help available. And that's all I really wanted to do when you and I started talking is, as I said in the first show, I had no idea what the connection would be between the fertility doctor or infertility doctor and the money doctor, but it turned out to be very logical. So I'm sorry, I'm on a soapbox here, but I'm just wanting to empower people to get the information that they need to make the decision and not just say, here's another thing I'm afraid I can't afford.
You bring up such good points, and really the key is that it can be hard to take the first step, just like everything in life and in finance also. If you don't know what is out there and available, it can be almost impossible to take that first step. But luckily, it's very easy to get an appointment with a fertility specialist to talk about it. It's not that hard. It takes basically 2 weeks to get in with us, for example, for a visit. You can do telehealth and get all the information. And if you have insurance, they will cover that first visit for sure. It's part of just like a regular doctor visit,
I love to bring people into the behind the scenes stuff that I probably shouldn't, but what happens on break, what happens before we get in the room here, what happens afterwards sometimes shows up in these shows as fun little asides, and you're having a red letter day there. Can you share the second story with us? Since we've been on the air, two things have happened.
I got the news that a patient of mine who's been working at this for at least a year. She'd been trying to conceive for multiple years, did low level fertility treatment. It didn't work. We ended up doing IVF, discovered there are some egg quality issues that you would never know if you didn't do IVF because you can't watch the embryos develop inside your body. You can't see what's going to happen. And she had done prior, she had made three embryos over the course of multiple IVF cycles, and the first two, unfortunately, very, very, very early losses. And today she has a positive test from her final embryo, and the number is excellent, and just thrilled for her. Just so excited.
Very exciting. Very exciting. I hope you'll keep us posted on that.
Can I throw something in here too?
Of course, Jay.
None of us obviously have a crystal ball, doc, but it seems as though, and I know so, the medical industry has seen, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, have made mental health a priority. And you go to your doctor, at least at a certain age, at least at my age, they ask, have you been depressed the past couple of weeks? Do you see any kind of a trend where fertility treatments and the whole process might become more of a priority? And it wouldn't be the entire population. Because obviously, you're not going to see somebody at 60 to see if they're going to try to have a baby. But
Our
you know what I'm
comp is
saying? Is
55.
there a movement, or does the medical industry see that as maybe something to prioritize and help fund?
I really hope so. I think some of it does have to come from the top down. Certainly, there are states that have insurance mandates and so on for fertility treatment. And it's coming more throughout the country, which is really great. In many countries around the world, fertility treatment is funded by the government. And if you meet certain criteria, you can do whatever you need to do, basically, up to a certain limit, and then they won't fund it anymore. You raise a really good point about mental health. We take mental health very seriously here. I see lots and lots of folks who have, mental health issues are very prevalent today, regardless. But certainly, fertility challenges can exacerbate a lot of mental health issues, as I'm sure you can imagine. So in our practice anyway, we do have counselors and so on to meet with folks. We have anybody that has, unfortunately, like a pregnancy loss in our practice meets with one of our counselors for support in that circumstance, as well as the rest of the team. So we take it very seriously here.
I do remember one of my doctors asking me more than once as I was getting up to that 35-year-old, my biological clock is ticking like this. I do remember her asking me more than once, are you sure? Are you thinking of having babies because you're healthy, but you ought to be starting to, pull the trigger on that if you're thinking of that. And I always appreciated that she checked in with me about that, but I don't know if everybody does. And it would be one simple question. Just bring it up. See if people are if they're thinking it, or if they're thinking like most of us, hey, I'm invincible, I still feel great. I could still have babies. So I think most people think of infertility, doctor, as IVF. They go straight to IVF, in vitro. But what's one surprising option or an advancement something surprising, if there is something surprising, that families don't usually realize is available.
So before folks get to IVF, you can do often low-level fertility treatments. And actually, the first-line treatment for folks that are young and have no obvious issues going on is not to do IVF. It's not usually the first line. It is to do low-level fertility treatments like oral medicine, monitoring, an injection to make sure that the ovulation is happening at the appropriate time. And intrauterine insemination, which is where we take the sperm and spin it down, get rid of all the abnormal sperm. We end up with half a milliliter of the best and the brightest, and put them into the uterus from below. It doesn't hurt or anything like that, is what the patients tell me. And that will more than double the chances of pregnancy for some people in the month. And that's a very often very mellow approach. Oral medicine, a visit to the office. I mean, it's not a huge. It can feel like not as much of a burdensome process that for some folks IVF can feel like.
Jay had asked me when I said you were coming on as a guest, is this mostly for affluent families? And is that who you see more often? I mean, is it really an uphill struggle to get people to understand that there might be affordable methods?
In our practice, we see really the whole spectrum of income that you can
You
imagine.
do.
Certainly, affluent folks, but also folks that are not as affluent and folks that don't have jobs and anything you can imagine. So we do see that. A lot of it does depend about if they proceed with treatment. Often there is a financial component to it, which is why we do everything we can to help them and make sure they have access to all the resources they can. But we do see the whole spectrum of folks here.
Well,
There
we
was
certainly
a.
hope you're enjoying this as much as we are. This is fascinating stuff. And we have some more time with Dr. Alex coming up, but Francis, can we get your phone number first?
Sure. I'm so surprised we've gone through this time already. 413-773-3333.
That's why I'm watching the clock for you.
Thank you.
As always, you can go to hugyourmoney.com too to get more information. And we will be back with more with Dr. Alex coming right up on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. Hug Your Money, where financial wellness gets personal.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and Dr. Alex.
Dr. Alex Kucherov, thank you for joining us from Ulum. I had a lovely woman who worked with me, and she went through two times as a surrogate mom while she worked with me. And she said, oh, it's the best thing she ever did. She's maintained relationships with this. Once was a heterosexual couple, once was a gay couple, two men. I think she just loved the process, absolutely loved it. She said she never felt better. She felt like she was really doing something for people. Do you deal with surrogate pregnancies in your practice, and how?
In our practice, absolutely. Gay Parents to Be, the organization, is part of our practice and was founded by our founder, Dr. Mark Landeris, who's also our medical director. He and one of the other doctors here, Dr. Laura Meyer, see the majority of folks that need surrogacy to build their families, mostly same-sex male couples who need both donor eggs and a uterus. Very complicated, you can imagine.
Right.
So we do a lot of surrogacy here. Very importantly, the laws have changed, at least in this part of the country, the past couple of years. Surrogacy has been legal in Connecticut for a long time, but just recently, the past couple of years, the laws changed in New York State about surrogacy. In the olden days, the 80s, it was a little bit different where folks could be the egg donor and also the surrogate. You can imagine that that would create issues at the time of adoption of the baby, where folks would have a baby and their egg was used to make that baby. And there, you can imagine that the challenges that that would present. So nowadays, there is always a separation of those things. There is one person that is the egg donor and a separate person that is the surrogate. But yes, we do a lot of surrogacy here. And I've had folks that have used surrogates as well in my practice.
I think it's great, but you brought to mind the strangest thing about Cecil Jacobson. You know who I mean, Cecil Jacobson? Cecil Jacobson used his own sperm without disclosing it to impregnate his patients. So you really want to, if you're going to look into this, you really want somebody reputable. Yeah, it was a long time ago, but you want ethics and transparency. You shouldn't have reminded me of that, but you did. And you know what else you reminded me of was Louise Brown, 1978, test tube baby, right? So, I don't know. I have too many questions, but I just want to go back for a minute to the people that you see. I guess out of curiosity, I just wonder if you could change something about the funding part, right? If you could change one thing about how fertility services are funded or covered in the United States, and we can talk about what happens in other countries too, what would it be? Maybe the answer is obvious, maybe not.
I mean, to me, the obvious answer is that public insurance should cover fertility testing and treatment. I think there's no question that that's the most important thing and the next big thing that has to happen in this country. We certainly Medicaid programs in New York and in Connecticut do not cover, often don't cover even a fertility like visit or checkup, and certainly don't cover any fertility treatment. Now, there are, I'm sure, the powers that be that have run the numbers on this, and we'll see what the numbers show. But from a medical standpoint, this is, fertility treatment is really the only thing that if you have a fertility medical diagnosis, you cannot get access to care under certain circumstances. There's nothing else medically in this country that you can't do. Like if you have appendicitis and you go to the hospital, it doesn't matter what's going on. You're getting your appendix out or getting antibiotics. Like they're going to make that clinical decision and move forward. It doesn't matter what your status is. If you have cancer, you can get chemotherapy or whatever you need. Like it'll get figured out, Fertility is the one thing that's not like that. And you can have fertility issues through no fault of your own, and you can still have no access to care because of that. It's very challenging and annoying.
Are there areas where the US, I might know the answer to this question too, but are there areas where the US lags other countries about making fertility affordable and accessible,
In
fertility
many
treatment?
other countries, yeah, in many other countries, fertility treatment, if you're paying out of pocket, is way less expensive. Now, the primary reason for that is that there is government funding, even for folks that are using private payments to pay for fertility services. The labs and the practices still receive money from the government. So, classic example, and you might hear about this, people going to Europe to freeze their eggs.
I was just going to ask that actually. Yep.
People do that. And I've heard lots of stories about it. I've had patients that have done it. I had a patient who froze her eggs in Denmark, and had her donor sperm actually in Denmark and wanted to ship everything over to us. And unfortunately, we couldn't accept it. There's lots of issues with sending gametes between countries. You can
You
imagine
think you
getting
can't send a plant between countries?
So in many other countries, it can be less expensive, whereas, certainly in this country, we have no support like that. So things are necessarily more expensive. Now we have high standards for our labs here, just like they do in Europe. And to keep those standards high, sometimes it is expensive. It does cost money.
Are you seeing more and more employers offering this fertility coverage as part of a workplace benefit? I ask because we're now a workplace benefit, right? And I'm heartened by the fact that employers actually seem to care more and more about their employees. There's a bottom line to it, right? They care about keeping people, they care about attracting talent, they care about that. But I think, we used to see corporate heads as, bottom line number crunchers. And I'm finding that no, they actually want to do good things for their people.
I
So are
think
you seeing it with fertility coverage?
we're absolutely seeing it more,
You are.
certainly than we used to, 5, 10 years ago. Many insurance companies, as part of their insurance package, will cover fertility treatment. Even more so, some of the larger companies, for instance, tech companies, international companies, law firms, and finance companies, sometimes they have what are called third-party carve-outs for fertility coverage. So these are companies that are separate from the insurance company that take ownership of the fertility treatment process. And in many cases, Those will also cover elective fertility preservation, so egg freezing and so on. And that is a really amazing benefit that it's that type of stuff certainly did not exist in the recent past. And it's an amazing benefit that many folks do have access to that they did not in the past.
And that they might not know about.
They might not know about.
They really need to ask. And they need to maybe not just ask their HR person, but actually call the company and dig in and find out, or get an advocate to help you at some place like a Loom or.
This is a tough question. I don't know if you'll be able to really. You're great with answers, but I don't know if I'm asking you something that you won't be able to expound on. How do you balance best medical practice with what's realistically affordable for a couple or an individual?
So it really is personalized, and based on their specific situation. For example, if someone comes to see us and the female testing is all normal and the sperm numbers are very low, they might, and IVF really is really the only way to proceed, and they feel that they can't afford it. They say, well, but maybe we can try IUI. That costs, a tenth of what IVF costs, generally. But if the success rate is like 1%, that's hard to put through. Now you might be cynical and say, hey, you should just do it and you can try it and that's fine. And if they have coverage for it and they want to give it a try and it's not a 0% chance of working, it's fair to do that, right? Everybody deserves a chance, I would say. But certainly if they were paying out of pocket or didn't have coverage for it, I am always open and honest with people about what their chances of success are with any given method and approach based on the best available evidence and research. And in some cases, I would recommend people not do certain treatments. It might be a waste of money, honestly. In the chance of success is so low and not appreciably higher than just trying on your own. It might not be worth the investment, let's say.
Well, you did give us a great answer. I really appreciate that.
Going back to the previous show, Doc, it's again, just for me, it's just a matter of here's something else miraculous. Although, if you're having some sort of an organ transplant, there's always a chance that something can be rejected. But I think I remember you saying that eggs, generally speaking, there's little or no rejection.
So it's rare to have a situation where the body itself is, in quotes, rejecting a pregnancy. Not to say that folks that are going through a pregnancy loss don't feel that way, because that is actually the most common way to feel is like, what did I do wrong? Why am I having a pregnancy loss? Why am I having a negative test all the time? Putting it on themselves, whereas usually it is something else actually about the embryo itself that is causing that. But the body itself typically for most folks is not what's going, not rejecting in quotes a pregnancy. Now there are certain circumstances where people have things going on that might increase the risk of pregnancy loss. For instance, hypercoagulability disorders, thyroid disorders, various other medical things that can certainly lead to those increased risks. And those can be addressed medically, medications, et cetera. But as a general rule, there are not usually things going on with the body that will outright reject a pregnancy.
I did find that fascinating because if you implanted just about anything else into your body, your body would say, "Hey, that's foreign, that's not mine." And I also found fascinating that you talked about when one woman in a same-sex couple, if one woman is carrying the embryo as a vessel, that she might think she's just like, a flower vase, right? But you didn't use that term, but I am. But in fact, she's actually contributing something to that embryo. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, beyond the obvious, being pregnant for 9 months and then having a delivery experience, which is a lot, of course, being a mom, amazing. Yes, the body does direct traffic for development of embryos and in the placenta. The uterus tells certain genes in the developing baby to turn on and turn off through a process called methylation, adding hydrogen atoms in a unique way to the DNA, and also through a process called imprinting. This is the same kind of idea. Basically leads to that baby being a unique individual. such that if that embryo was carried by a different person in their uterus, they would alter the DNA in a different way, and that would be a different human being that was born. Amazing.
It is amazing. So I want to thank you again, Dr. Alexander Kucherov, for joining us. You know, to have somebody double board certified, OBGYN, reproductive endocrinology and infertility from Alum, to just peel back the curtain and say, here's what's going on. Here's how you can afford things. Your insights really do remind us that fertility care isn't just about science and medicine, but it is about timing and access and making the journey affordable and realistic for families. And so I thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us and giving our followers a clearer picture of both the possibilities and the challenges involved in building a family today. Yeah,
My
thank
pleasure.
you.
Thanks for having me.
Doc, thank you very much. Francis, I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number again to pass along to them?
Yes, but I cannot answer any of those medical questions.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com. And again, join us next time around for Financial Fitness with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram.